Well, as is customary here, we like to start on time. I know you people are busy people with lots of pressing things to do, and we do appreciate you coming out on a very rainy evening. Good evening and welcome to the first presentation in this, our 11th series of talks on Kentucky Live, Southern Culture at its Best, sponsored by the Friends of WKU Libraries. My name is Brian Coots, and as head of the Department of Library Public Services at WKU, I coordinate this series with my absent colleague, Peggy Wright, who's recovering from knee surgery in the hospital tonight, and with help from our library support staff. Ryan Dowell and Christopher McConnell designed our posters, and our technical specialist tonight is Shadon Atts. Our speaker tonight is a native of Jefferson County, whose family roots extend to Barron County, Kentucky, and Scottsburg, Indiana. He said he had no idea what he wanted to be when he grew up, and thus entered college almost a decade after high school. He then pursued an interest in history, which he developed in grade school at the University of Louisville, where he received his BA and MA. After college, he went to work for United Distillers as the North American archivist for 4 years until they sold their bourbon brands and closed their archive in 1996. He joined the Filson Historical Society in Louisville in 1997 as a special collections assistant, rising to become associate curator of special collections. In July of this year, he became the official bourbon historian for the Filson Historical Society. We were talking about, is he the only one? And he may be the only professional bourbon historian in the country. His role at the Filson now is to spread the word about the Filson and to raise funds while doing so. He teaches the Filson Bourbon Academy, an 8-hour course on bourbon history and tasting several times a year, and plans to take the class to several cities, including Chicago, St. Louis, and Washington, D.C., by the end of this year. He's written about bourbon for years on the internet forums and Filson publications and in print, including articles for the Louisville Encyclopedia and the foreword to the re-release of Carson's Social History of Bourbon. In March of 2013, his book, Kentucky Bourbon Whiskey, An American Heritage, was published by the University Press of Kentucky to considerable acclaim. According to Imbibe magazine, he spent almost 2 decades sifting through the personal papers of bourbon's royal families and studying the distilling industry and culture of the time to dispel myths. This has earned him a place in the Kentucky Bourbon Hall of Fame. When not talking about or researching bourbon, he enjoys fishing and camping and University of Louisville football and basketball. And here to tell us the real story about how bourbon originated and a lot more about bourbon is Mike Beach. Mike?
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be down in Bowling Green. I always enjoyed Bowling Green. My dad was raised in Barron County, and one of his claims to fame was is that his basketball coach at Austin Tracy High School was a player for Diddle. So I've always had a great respect also for Western Kentucky basketball as well. So, you know, go Toppers. So, bourbon. There are a lot of myths and legends out there about bourbon. That's one of the toughest jobs about being a bourbon historian is to decide what is real history and what's, you know, the myth and legend. The myths and legends are developed mostly because of marketing. People think of marketing as a fairly recent thing, but believe me, it has been around for a long time. So let's talk about the origins of bourbon and some of the legends involved. You go back into the early days of Kentucky, and you got to remember, Kentucky is the first American West. This was the Wild West in the 1770s, 1780s, 1790s. And when people came into Kentucky in that period, they brought the things that they need to live, and it was a very rough life. Now, they brought the tools they needed to build cabins, to build a farm, to do their farming, and they brought their stills. And they brought their stills because whiskey was a very important part of the early cultural life in Kentucky. When you come into this area, it was, like I said, it was a very hard life. You worked from sun up to sundown, and whiskey helped make your life a little more bearable. You know, the term having an eye opener in the morning comes from the early days of these frontiersmen when they would drink a shot of whiskey when they first got up in the morning to help them deal with the aches and pains they're going to be dealing with through the day for all this hard work. Whiskey was a very important part of the cultural life. You know, whenever you had a barn raising or a cabin raising or a funeral or a wedding, someone brought a jug. And they also learned very early on that it was a lot safer to drink your river water with a little whiskey in it than it was to drink that river water straight. You didn't get as sick. Distilling was a very important part of the life. Most of the people, when they came in here into Kentucky, they brought stills with them that ranged anywhere from 20 gallons to 200 gallons. Now, one of the big myths, and you hear this even at the distilleries, they'll say the Kentucky distillers came into Kentucky because of the Whiskey Rebellion. And that's not true. There were plenty of distillers in Kentucky before the Whiskey Rebellion. Sam Thomas, the late Sam Thomas, historian in Louisville, he was giving a talk at the Louisville Public Library, and someone was asking about Evan Williams being the first Kentucky distiller. And he says, that's not true. We really don't know who it was. And he said, well, who do you think it was? And he said, whoever was supplying George Rogers Clark on Corn Island, I would say. And that's probably true. The Whiskey Rebellion did not bring distillers into Kentucky. As a matter of fact, the Whiskey Rebellion was just as bad here in Kentucky as it was in western Pennsylvania. So, just to give us a little background here on the Whiskey Rebellion and what it was all about. You know, when the Constitution was passed, one of the things they did to pass it was to say, we will assume the Revolutionary War debts from the states if they join this new federal government. So, in order to pay those debts, they had to raise revenues. They did that through tariffs and through an excise tax on whiskey. Now, the distillers in western Pennsylvania and Kentucky, they didn't like the tax. Nobody likes taxes. But what they didn't like in particular was that it was a very unfair tax. First of all, if you were in the cities in the east, you know, along the Atlantic seaboard and everything, the tax was collected by an internal revenue agent right at the still. You made 20 gallons of whiskey, you paid taxes on 20 gallons of whiskey that day. But if you were out in what they called rural distilleries, out in western Pennsylvania or Kentucky, they only had one tax collector for a huge area. You know, there was only one tax collector for all of Kentucky. So what they would do is they would go out, they would go to the farmer distiller, and they would look at a still and say, okay, this size still can make this much whiskey in 6 months. This is how much tax you owe us. Problem was, these farmer distillers weren't making whiskey 6 months of the year. They may make it 3 months of the year, but that'd be about it. So they were being taxed for whiskey that they weren't even making. But then to make matters worse, the tax had to be paid in specie, hard currency. Now, if you know any of your Kentucky history at all, if in Kentucky, western Pennsylvania, West Virginia, Tennessee, the areas which now became Tennessee, hard currency was very hard to come by. A lot of people were making whiskey because it was also currency. It was bartered all the way up, you know, into the 1820s. When Abraham Lincoln's father left Kentucky for Indiana, he took 6 barrels of whiskey with him. He didn't do that because he was thirsty. He did that because that's what he bought his farm in Indiana with. So whiskey was currency. That you would barter your whiskey for other goods that you needed, and you couldn't pay the tax in whiskey. So the distillers rebelled. They complained. They tarred and feathered tax collectors, both in western Pennsylvania and here. In western Pennsylvania, they actually burned the house down for one of the tax collectors, and one of the people was shot and killed. This violence, of course, caused Alexander Hamilton to go to George Washington and said, we have to do something about this. We need to raise an army and show them that we are determined to collect the taxes. And that's exactly what happened. They raised an army and moved into western Pennsylvania. And one of my favorite quotes from Thomas Jefferson at the time is that a rebellion was declared, armed for, marched against, and never found. They got into western Pennsylvania and they only arrested 10 people. And of those 10, only 2 of them were convicted. And George Washington later, as president, pardoned both of them because one of them was described as an imbecile and the other one was described as an idiot. I'm not really sure what the difference was between the two, but the imbecile was also a preacher, so maybe there's something religious involved with being an imbecile instead of an idiot. I don't know. If you fled Pennsylvania, you didn't stop in Kentucky. You went all the way to Louisiana territory, Spanish territory, because the federal marshals that were looking for you in western Pennsylvania had just as much jurisdiction here in Kentucky as they did in western Pennsylvania. I know of no distillers that actually came here because they were fleeing the Whiskey Rebellion. So what was happening in Kentucky that was different? The government, it's really kind of the first government cover-up. The federal government, Hamilton and such, did not want to march an army into Kentucky for two major reasons. One of them was they didn't think they could supply an army into Kentucky, because you got to remember, crossing the Appalachians was a very difficult thing at that time. There were no railroads or highways. It was a very difficult thing. And the other problem was they were afraid that if they did that, the people of Kentucky would say the heck with the United States and join with Spain, because Spanish territory, St. Louis and Louisiana, New Orleans, was the natural trading partner with Kentucky at the time. What they did in Kentucky is they sent a very sympathetic federal judge to Kentucky. He tied the cases up in the courts. The cases were not settled until the 1820s, and they were settled without any penalty. And of course, by the 1820s, hard currency was much easier to come by, and people paid their taxes without any complaints. As I alluded to earlier, the natural trade route out of Kentucky at this time is down the Ohio River to the Mississippi and into New Orleans and St. Louis. Early on, this was not a very viable trade. The Spanish were using the trade with New Orleans as a bargaining chip with the new federal government in treaties. The problem was, you know, Kentucky's the 15th state, and when there was only 15 states, it was the only state west of the Appalachian. All the others were on the Atlantic seaboard. Trade with New Orleans had very little meaning to the rest of the states. They were not putting serious negotiations in to opening the ports of New Orleans. So it was very rare for people to be able to make trips to New Orleans and do trade because of the Spanish government. To make matters worse, it was a very dangerous trip. You had Native Americans on both sides of the river that were more than happy to rob people going down the river in flatboats. You also had river pirates. Anybody here ever heard of Cave In Rock in southern Illinois? It's a big cave right on the Ohio River that was very well known in the 1700s as a river pirate den. Just a little aside here, about 8 or 10 years ago, we got a call at the Filson from Disney. They were interested in our Young E. Allison papers, because back in the 1790s, he wrote a little song for a musical play. He was a poet and a playwright about the pirates at Cave In Rock. And the song was called The Derelict. You all might recognize it as Yo-Ho-Ho and a Bottle of Rum. And they were looking to find out who owned the trademark rights to that song so they could use it in their Pirates of the Caribbean movie. Unfortunately, the Filson couldn't prove that they owned the trade rights, otherwise they'd be making a little more money now. River pirates were a very big danger at the time. So you would build your flatboat, you would take it down the river, you would take it to New Orleans, you would sell your goods, then you would sell your flatboat, because you weren't going to roll that flatboat back up against the current up the Mississippi and the Ohio River. A lot of people don't realize a lot of the early houses in New Orleans, particularly the early shotgun houses, are built with Kentucky lumber, because that's what they would do. They would take those boats apart and build houses with them. And then once you sold the your goods and the flatboat, you had two choices. You could catch ship in New Orleans and sail around to the Atlantic coast and come back into Kentucky the way you originally came in, or you could walk back up the Natchez Trace. Yes, you could ride a horse, but the Natchez Trace was a very primitive road, and it really wasn't that much faster. But, you know, the legend has it is that's where Kentucky's thoroughbred industry comes from, is because people making the trade trip down to New Orleans would buy thoroughbreds down there and bring them back to Kentucky. But it was also a very dangerous track, because once again, you had Native Americans and you had bandits, and they all knew that if you were a Kentuckian coming back from New Orleans, the one thing you did have was hard currency, money. So you had to deal with that. So it was about an 8 month to maybe even a year trip to make the trip down to New Orleans. Well, things start to change with the beginning of the new century. First of all, Thomas Jefferson is elected president in 1800 with the promise that he is going to balance the federal budget and eliminate the whiskey tax. And believe it or not, we had a president that kept his word. He did just that. In 1802, he had the federal budget balanced, and he eliminated the whiskey tax. Then in 1803, he purchases Louisiana. Now, trade with New Orleans becomes a very viable thing for the people in the West, in Kentucky and the new Northwestern territories and things like that. So, you start having people taking trade goods down to New Orleans. It becomes a very profitable thing for Kentuckians. You know, and the legend has it that that's where bourbon is born. You know, the legend has it that Elijah Craig created bourbon in 1789. I've heard several stories. One was is that he had a bunch of barrel staves that were in a fire, and they burned evidently all on one side, and he just put the burnt side on the inside of the barrel, and when he put his whiskey in there, he found that it changed the flavor and gave it some color. The other story is that he was too cheap to buy new barrels, so he bought he had a barrel that had salted fish in it, so he burned the inside of it to get the salted fish smell out and put his whiskey in it, and that's where bourbon came from. Well, neither one of these stories makes much sense. For one thing, if you know anything at all about barrels, there are different qualities of barrels, and they had what they called dry barrels. Dry barrels were put together in order to ship things, because, you know, the barrel at that time was the forecarat of the age. You know, since the time of the Romans, they learned to use barrels because you could move a lot of goods easy. They roll, and you can stand them up, and only one person can do all this. But dry barrels don't have to be tightly made, and they're used for, you know, anything from nails to crackers to salted fish. So, you know, if he was, unless the guy spent a lot of extra money to buy a wet barrel to put his salted fish in, that story just doesn't make any sense. But the other fact is I don't care how much you burn the inside of the barrel that's had salted fish in it, it's still going to make your whiskey taste like salted fish. And bourbon does not taste like salted fish. Who did create the first bourbon? That's a good question. My primary argument that I use in my book for why Elijah Craig didn't do it is because the first advertisement for bourbon whiskey being for sale in a Kentucky newspaper is 1821. If he invented bourbon in 1789, you can't tell me it took 32 years for someone to put it up for sale. 1821 is the first mention of bourbon. It makes sense that this happens, particularly, you know, in the 1790s you had the whiskey tax. And most of these farmer distillers, like I said, had stills from 20 gallons to 200 gallons. If you had a 100-gallon still and you worked all day, and if you were a really good distiller, you made 10 gallons of whiskey. You don't put that in a barrel. You put it in a jug. You do that for another reason, because you have to pay taxes on that whiskey. And if you put whiskey into a barrel, when they put whiskey into the 52-gallon barrels of today, within a month, 3 gallons are gone, because it soaks into the wood. That's three gallons worth of taxes you just lost if you had to pay it right off the still. So you put it in a jug. 1802, the tax is gone. The tax is gone all the way until 1814. From 1814 to 1817, there's a whiskey tax once again in order to pay for our Second War of Independence. But from 1817 to 1861, there is no whiskey tax. So this allows people to start putting it into barrels and absorb that loss and start aging whiskey. Now, we know from the papers at the Filson Historical Society and the John Corliss papers, the Corliss Respice family papers, John Corliss was started life up in Providence, Rhode Island. He was in the shipping industry. Things were going well until the War of 1812 when the embargo really hurt his business. Not only his shipping industry, but he was also running a gin distillery in Providence. And he was having trouble getting rye whiskey or rye grain to make the gin for his distillery because of the embargo. To make matters worse, he has two ships seized by the Spanish off the coast of South America, and before he can get any type of legal compensation for them, the South Americans have their revolutions. It takes him to the 1830s to finally get some kind of legal settlement. He sells everything he has in Providence, Rhode Island, and comes to Bourbon County, Kentucky, where he buys a farm and he buys a whiskey distillery. Now, to my point, he made his money taking flatboats full of tobacco down the Ohio River to New Orleans, where he used his connections in the shipping industry to take this tobacco to Great Britain and to France, where they could sell it for real hard currency, big bucks. Sometimes he made this trip himself. Sometimes he would send a factor, a business representative. When he sent a factor, the factor would write back to him and tell him the prices of goods in New Orleans. And we know from these letters, the price of whiskey in the 1815, 1816, 1817 era was the same in New Orleans as it was in Kentucky. John Corliss never bothered to send whiskey to Kentucky, to New Orleans, because all it would do was take up space on his flatboats that he could fill with tobacco, where he was making money. So, someone said, they're not buying our whiskey in New Orleans, not for a profit. So, who are these people? What are they drinking? The answer is quite simple. They're Frenchmen. Many of them are in New Orleans because they didn't like what was going on in France in the 1790s with the French Revolution. They literally came to America to keep their heads. A lot of them were loyalists. What were they drinking? They're drinking French brandy, cognac, Armagnac. And I always challenge people, take a glass of bourbon, a glass of cognac, and a glass of any single malt scotch you want. Tell me which two taste most alike. Everybody I've talked to said the bourbon and the cognac taste more alike than bourbon and scotch. So, as I point out in my book, my prime suspects for doing this are the Tarascon brothers. Two Frenchmen that come from an area in France just south of the cognac region. They come to the Americas, they come to Louisville in the 18-teens. I think one brother got there about 1813, the other one got there about 1815. They built a warehouse and a mill at the Falls of the Ohio in Shippingport. At that time, it was just west of Louisville. They know about cognac and French brandy. They know about the people because they came to Louisville to set up trade with New Orleans. They knew who they were dealing with. They had ample opportunity to get a hold of whiskey cheap because as you came down the Ohio River and you came to Louisville, you unloaded your goods and you put your goods in a warehouse. Tarascon Brothers had one right there at the falls. You waited till the river rose and you sent your flatboat over the falls because there was no Portland Canal at the time. If it survived, you loaded up and kept on going. If it didn't, you either bought a new flatboat or you sold your goods to somebody who would buy them there in Louisville. So they had an opportunity to get hold of whiskey cheap. They know about putting it in charred barrels to make it taste more like cognac, and they're trying to build the trade with New Orleans. I highly suspect they're the ones that invented the first bourbon. They probably weren't calling it bourbon, though. They were probably calling it Kentucky brandy or something, because, like I said, marketing is a very old thing. As a matter of fact, I've seen ledgers and diary entries where people talk about the price of French brandy in New Orleans and then the price of domestic brandy, and with a note next to it saying, this is not real brandy, it's made from corn. It's bourbon. So, where did bourbon get its name? You know, the legend has it that it came from Bourbon County because they would put their goods in the port of Limestone, and it had the Bourbon County invoices on their barrels, and they would send it down to New Orleans, and people started asking for whiskey coming from that Bourbon County. I would love for this to be true, but this story, you don't see it until the 1870s. You don't see anything more contemporary with this story. In my opinion, it's just as likely that bourbon is named after Bourbon Street. Because once you start sending this whiskey down to New Orleans that tastes more like cognac, you know, eventually people are going to catch on that it's really whiskey and not real brandy. But they're going to be down there, and they like it. Particularly in the 18-teens and the 1820s, when you start having steamboat traffic going up and down the Ohio and Mississippi rivers. We had a researcher at the Filson several years ago that was doing steamboat research. And she told me that everybody on a steamboat worked for the owners of that boat, whether it was, the captain or a corporation or whatever, except the bartender. The bartender was an independent operator who had to invest his own money into the liquors and the goods that he sold at the bar. But he also got to keep all the profits. So if you're an independent bartender and you start having people that are making the trip to New Orleans and back, and they're coming back and saying, I really like that whiskey I was drinking down on Bourbon Street. Give me some of that Bourbon Street whiskey. Or eventually give me some of that bourbon whiskey. You're going to make sure you have it. And I think that is probably where the name bourbon comes from. As much as I would love for it to be named after Bourbon County, I don't think it is. Limestone was only part of Bourbon County for 2 years, and during those 2 years, the Spanish controlled New Orleans, so there wasn't that much trade going on. The one thing I always do agree on, though, it's named for the French royal family, the Bourbons. So, another early myth that I guarantee if you go tour a distillery, they're going to be telling this, particularly in their films. They're going to say that the corn writs caused the settlement of Kentucky. That if you came into Kentucky and built the cabin and you raised 40 acres of corn, you would get free land. That's not true. Kentucky, all the land in Kentucky was pretty much given away before the corn writs were even written up. Virginia used land in Kentucky to pay off the Revolutionary War debts. The early story is that when you bought land in Kentucky, you didn't buy a deed, you bought a lawsuit, because nobody knew where, the surveys weren't done in a very systematic manner. There was a lot of arguments over boundaries, etc. What the corn writs did, actually, in many ways, took away land from people in Kentucky. Because the corn writs were written because, you may have heard of the Transylvania Company and Daniel Boone. They made a treaty with the Cherokee Indians for land in Kentucky. They came in here, they sold the land, settled, made land claims. Then the state of Virginia didn't recognize that treaty or the right for the Transylvania Company to sell that land. But they did recognize that the people that bought land from them did it in good faith. And they couldn't just take everything they had away from them. So what the corn writs did was saying that if you were in Kentucky and you built a cabin and you had raised 40 acres of corn, we will recognize 400 acres of your claim. You may have had a claim for 10,000 acres, but you got 400. So that is another one of the early myths and legends of the day. Now that we know where bourbon came from, or the early years of bourbon, where I think it came from, let's start talking about the formative years. The 1830s, 1840s, all the way up to the Civil War. Once again, we're still talking about a very primitive industry. It's a cottage industry, farmer distillers. But you are starting to see some of these farmer distillers are going into distilling full-time. And they're expanding their distilleries, and they're making a lot more whiskey. And they're beginning to make bourbon. The earliest reference that I have found to charring barrels, once again, comes from John Corliss in the Corliss Recipes family papers. In 1826, a Lexington grocer writes to Corliss saying, "I really like your whiskey. I'll take another 100 barrels, 10 barrels at a time until you can fill it out. But I've been told that if you will burn or char the inside of the barrel as little as a 16th of an inch, it will greatly improve the flavor of the whiskey." So this is a Lexington grocer telling a Bourbon County distiller how to make bourbon in 1826. So the idea of putting in charred barrels is still a very new idea. Most of the people at that time were selling just basically what we would call corn whiskey today. And they were flavoring it. They were making what they would call their blackberry cordial by taking blackberries and throwing it in there and flavoring it with it. Or making cherry bounce, where they were using either wild cherries themselves, or in some cases I've seen they take wild cherry root and brew a real strong tea and flavor that their whiskey with that tea and some sugar. That's what most of them were drinking at the time, but you start seeing the beginnings of bourbon whiskey at this time. Things really take off, though, in the 1830s, when a guy named James Christopher Crow shows up in Anderson County and goes to work for Oscar Pepper at his distillery. James Christopher Crow said he was a doctor from the University of Edinburgh. Oscar Pepper took him for his word. He didn't bother to write the University of Edinburgh because it had taken probably 6 months to a year to get a letter there. And then even if they bothered to send back a reply, it'd be another 6 months to a year to get it back. Crow appeared to be a very educated person. He took his word for it, which is good because the University of Edinburgh's never heard of James Christopher Crow. But he was very well educated. My best theory, and I've talked this over with several people that have done some research with him, he probably was from Edinburgh, but there were a lot of poor people at that time who would hang out and work in a bar where the college students hung out and basically learn from the college students. He had a good scientific background and knowledge, and when he came there, he decided, he went to work for Oscar Pepper as a distiller, and he decided to apply this knowledge to what he was doing. Now, there's a lot of legend saying that he invented sour mash. That's not true. The Kentucky Historical Society has a collection of Mary Carpenter papers. She's a woman distiller from the early 1800s. She inherited her distillery from her second husband. She did something that I've only seen once, and that was with this recipe. She dated her recipe. Now, how many people out here date their recipes? As someone pointed out to me the other day, it would take a woman to do that. But I'm glad she did, because this recipe is from 1818. And on one side, she has, this is my recipe for sweet mash whiskey. You flip it over, this is my recipe for sour mash whiskey. So sour mash process was around before James Crow. But what he did was he applied the scientific knowledge. He checked temperature, pH, specific gravity, everything you could think of at that time, alcohol content, etc., at every step of the way in making the whiskey in order to standardize his sour mash process so that he could make whiskey that would be consistent from batch to batch. But more importantly, he wrote it down. And when he passed away, other people were able to learn what he did. In the 19th century, Old Crow whiskey was the whiskey that all other whiskeys were judged by. If you made good whiskey, you made whiskey as good as Old Crow. Old Crow was very popular in his lifetime. He sold barrels to Henry Clay, who took it to Washington, D.C. to grease the wheels of government. And I do say barrels because the primary package for buying whiskey in the 19th century was the barrel. You did not buy bottled whiskey from the distillery. You bought barrels. And if you were a consumer, you would go to your liquor store or your saloon and you would take your flask or your jug or your bucket, whatever you wanted to put it in, and you would fill it right from the barrel. So just think of this. Everybody in the early 19th century, was getting barrel-proof, unfiltered whiskey. This was good in many ways, but it led to quality control problems. Every barrel is different, and even every barrel is going to change as it ages. So if you've had that barrel up on your back bar for 6 months, it may taste different after 6 months compared to what it tasted like when you first got it. But there was also the problem, you know, say you're out in Kansas City, and you know it's going to take you 2 or 3 months to get the steamboat up river to get your whiskey that you just bought from Kentucky, and you're getting to sell quite a bit of it. You think, well, you know, I'll just add a little water to it in order to make it stretch a little further. Or say you've already done that a couple of times, and you're thinking, you know, I'm still not going to get any of that whiskey in for another 3 or 4 months, but, you know, Joe Moonshiner over here makes pretty good stuff. I'll just put some of his stuff in there. So the quality could vary because of the retail aspect of it, because there were no regulations. You know, there was no tax, there was no regulations on it. Bottles were very expensive at that time. You could buy bottled bourbon. In the 1960s, national distillers had a contest to find the oldest bourbon bottle because they were hoping it was going to be an Old Crow bottle. It turned out to be a bottle from Benninger's grocery store in New York City from 1849. At the Filson, we have a scrapbook from a lithograph company. You know, lithographs were developed in the 1840s and 50s, bringing color to the world. Literally, before the lithograph, the world was kind of black and white as far as the print world was concerned. In his scrapbook, which is basically a sample book of all the different labels that he could make, were whiskey labels. He would be making whiskey labels if people weren't bottling it. They were very generic in size and terms. Most of them just say bourbon. There were a couple that actually did have bottler names on it. But still, it was a very expensive process. Glass had to be hand-blown. So this brings us to the next evolution in bourbon, and this comes with George Garvin Brown, founder of what is now Brown-Forman. He's from Mumfordsville, Kentucky, comes to Louisville in the 1860s and goes to Mayo High School, never does graduate. A couple of months short of graduating, he quits. He goes to work for a pharmaceutical salesman named Chambers. So he's out selling pharmaceuticals to doctors. What is he selling? He's selling whiskey. Because you got to remember, in the 1860s, you didn't have the pharmaceuticals that we have today. You had whiskey, you had laudanum, you had quinine, you had some opiates. That's about it. Well, the doctors are complaining about the quality of the whiskey that they're prescribing. George Garvin Brown gets the idea. He goes to Chambers and says, why don't we buy a bunch of barrels of whiskey, put them in a big vat until we come up with a flavor and a proof that we really like, then bottle it and sell it to the doctors that way so we can guarantee the quality in every bottle. Chambers says, it's a great idea. I'm not going to do it. I'm too old. But I'll tell you what. You raise $500. I'll talk to some of my customers and such. I'll see if I can't raise $500. We will match your $500. You can pay us back whenever you get into business and make the money. And we'll put you in business doing this. So he goes and partners with his older brother, J.T.S. Brown. They raise $500. And they come back to Chambers. And they're surprised to find out he didn't raise $500. He raised $5,000. And he sets them up into making, you know, do his new business. So the next problem becomes, what do we call it? You know, everybody here that works in the archives business in Kentucky probably knows this, but Brown is about as common a name in Kentucky as Smith and Jones. There are a lot of Browns. And besides, old Brown just does not sound like a good name for a whiskey. Which, another little side, back when Gary and Marty Regan were writing their book of bourbon and other fine American whiskeys, I was having dinner with them and Ed Foote, the master distiller. And Marty asked Ed, you know, if you could make any type of whiskey you wanted, what would you make? He said, well, first of all, I wouldn't make anything new because Old Foote just isn't a very good name. But his argument was that he was making Old Fitzgerald, and to him, that was the perfect whiskey anyway. So, Brown's dilemma is, what are we going to call this? Well, it was solved by one of the investors, a doctor named Dr. William Forrester. William Forrester was a bit of a hero. His father was a Dr. Forrester, William Forrester, but his family passed away when he was young. He was raised by the Speed family in Farmington. He was probably there when Abraham Lincoln visited the Speeds in the 1850s. He goes to U of L Medical School. He goes off to New York University School of Surgery. He comes back to open up a practice, and the war breaks out. He joins the 3rd Kentucky Cavalry Union. He goes off to be a surgeon for the cavalry. He gets captured. He gets sent to Andersonville. He saves a lot of lives in Andersonville practicing his medicine, not only of the Union prisoners, but also the Confederate guards. He did not discriminate on people. If he could help them, he would. He comes back to Louisville. He's a bit of a hero. He agrees to let them call the whiskey Old Forrester. It wasn't old because William Forrester was old. He was only a few years older than George Garvin Brown. It was old because the whiskey was old. So, as much as I like Brown Forman, I wish they would quit saying they were the first one to bottle whiskey, to bottle bourbon, because they weren't. But what they did do is actually more significant. They were the first bourbon that was sold only by the bottle. That is a more significant claim, in my opinion. I wish Brown-Forman would use that instead of being the first bottled bourbon. But like I said, bottles were very expensive. They had to be hand-blown. This starts to change in the 1880s. They developed a two-piece mold for making glass so they could start machine-blow glass. Brings down the price of bottles. In the 1890s, they create a three-piece mold, which brings down the cost even more. Bottled bourbon becomes more and more popular. This leads us to the Bottled and Bond Act of 1897, because the straight whiskey distillers were having a problem with what they were calling the rectifying industry. Straight whiskey, of course, is made, distilled, put into the warehouse, and let age. Rectified whiskey, it depended upon the company. Some rectifiers were simply buying whiskey from Distillery A and Distillery B, putting it together to create a flavor profile they liked, and bottling that up. Other people were making what we would call a blended whiskey today. They were taking neutral spirits and some aged whiskey, maybe adding a little cherry juice or prune juice to give it a little extra fruity flavor, and bottling that up. Other people were making what my favorite recipe. I've seen a recipe for engine whiskey. Engine whiskey was you buy neutral spirits, which were quite cheap at that time because in the 1840s they invented the column still, which allowed them to make a lot of whiskey cheap. And they could make it also at a higher proof. So they were buying neutral spirits, and they said you color it by taking your spit from your chewing tobacco, and that would give it the color. And because the Indians expected some burn in it, you put a little sulfuric acid in it. You shake all that up and you bottle it and you sell it. So you had a whole range of quality in these rectifying. And the problem was they could call it Kentucky bourbon. It didn't have to be straight whiskey to be bourbon at that time. And they were setting up shop in Kentucky just to call it Kentucky bourbon. The straight whiskey people wanted to do something about that. So what they did is they went to John C. Carlisle, a Kentuckian who was Secretary of Treasury under Cleveland, and they got the Bottled and Bond Act of 1897 passed. It was literally the last thing passed under the Cleveland administration. He literally signed it, got into the carriage, and went to McKinley's inauguration. What Bottled and Bond said, that every drop of whiskey in that bottle is from the same distillery, made in the same season, aged at least 4 years, and bottled at 100 proof. It didn't guarantee it was good whiskey, but it guaranteed it was straight whiskey. The rectifiers didn't like this law, but what could they do? But they really didn't like what happened in 1906 when the Pure Food and Drug Act was passed. Pure Food and Drug Act of 1906 was brought about because of the muckrakers in Chicago and the meatpacking industry, and it was passed, and then the big question became, what is whiskey?
What is bourbon?
Well, what is whiskey?
Well, and bourbon.
Bourbon was part of that, because bourbon is a whiskey.
Right.
All bourbon is whiskey, but not all whiskey is bourbon. The chemist for the agricultural department under Teddy Roosevelt, a guy named Wiley, he said only straight whiskey is whiskey. Everything else has to be labeled artificial or imitation. Needless to say, the rectifiers were very upset with this. But not only the American rectifiers, but the Canadians and the Scots and the Irish. Because every bit of whiskey brought into the United States from those countries would have had been called imitation, because they were not straight whiskeys. It goes into the law courts. Roosevelt leaves office, President Taft becomes president. He spends the first 9 months of his office as president, because he's from a very judicial family. His father was in the Supreme Court system. Taft goes on to become a Chief Justice of the Supreme Court after he's president. He knows that these regulations are not coming from Congress, they're coming from his department heads and his departments. He knows ultimately the decision is his to make. So he listens to both sides of the argument, and then on December 27, 1909, he comes out with the Taft decision on whiskey. I always say it had to be a good decision because nobody liked it. Straight whiskey people thought he didn't go far enough. The blended whiskey, the rectifiers thought he went too far. But the fact is he defined what is straight whiskey, what is blended whiskey, and what is imitation whiskey as we know it today. So that is when you really start seeing bourbon defined as we know it today. And Prohibition comes along. It adds some other regulations after Prohibition, but that is bourbon as we know it today. And I do believe I'm probably, I think I am through with my allotted time. Do I open it up for questions now and then do a book signing? Is that the best way to do it? Okay. So do I have to? Yes.
I think, would you explain how corn whiskey began to be popular in the United States as opposed to rye whiskey? Originally, it was rye.
Okay. Rye whiskey was very popular because rye was grown up in the northeastern part. Ovehaney, the used to be master distiller at Four Roses before he passed away about 10 years ago. He was at a seminar at the Getz Museum during the Bourbon Festival, and someone said, "So why is bourbon made out of corn?" He says, "Because that's what they grew in Kentucky. If they grew rice in Kentucky, it'd be made out of rice."
Comment was made, you could just throw the seed out there anywhere and corn would grow.
Right.
So they started making whiskey out of corn.
Right, and they did that because for the reasons that I mentioned earlier, because it was a very important social product, plus it was a very important economic product. They used it for barter and trade. It was a lot easier. You take 10 bushels of corn, you can turn that into a gallon of whiskey. It's a lot easier to put that gallon of whiskey in a jug on your mule than it is that 10 bushels of corn. So that's why bourbon is made out of corn.
One other quick question. And I think a lot of people think of bourbon as just being whiskey. Taft actually put a definition together of what bourbon was in terms of how much corn there could be in it.
Right.
Can you relate that to this?
Okay. The modern definition of bourbon, which is very similar to what Taft had, it has changed a little since then, but not much, is that it has to be at least 51% corn, Now, some people will say, cannot be more than 80% corn because then it's corn whiskey, but that's not true. It can be 100% corn if you want it to be. Corn whiskey is 80% corn, but it's also aged and used or brand new cooperage, uncharred cooperage. So that's what makes it different from bourbon. So it has to be at least 51% corn. And because you have corn as part of your recipe, you want to get some of that flavor in your final product. So, whiskey can be distilled as high as 180 proof. Bourbon can only be distilled as high as 160 proof. Because the higher proof you go, the less flavor you have from your grain. If you go to 190 proof, you have vodka. And the definition of vodka is an odorless, flavorless product. So it has to be 51% corn, distilled at no higher than 160 proof, and then it has to go into a brand new charred oak container at no higher than 125 proof. And that's the part that's been added since Taft, because before Taft it didn't have to be brand new. Once it's in the barrel, it is bourbon. There is no age requirement for bourbon, but if you want to call it straight bourbon, it has to be 2 years old. And if you want to bottle it without an age statement, it has to be at least 4 years old. Jimmy Russell tells the story that if you make a white oak bucket, char the inside, and if you bring your whiskey off the still at less than 125 proof, you can fill your bucket, walk over to bottles, and fill your bottles, and you have bourbon. Of course, the problem is you would have to put an age statement on there saying this bourbon is less than 1 day old. And the other problem is you'd have to throw away your bucket before you could do it again because you have to have a brand new bucket. Bourbon has to be bottled at no less than 80 proof, and it has to be a product of the United States. It does not have to be a product of Kentucky. It can be made anywhere in the United States, and that is bourbon. Yes?
What's the current trend in terms of popularity of bourbon?
Bourbon is growing in popularity worldwide. It is really taking off. Sales have been so much. I was talking earlier at dinner with a guy that works for one of the liquor stores here, and he was saying he could sell anything he gets. That's the problem is, with bourbon, you have to be a little bit of a fortune teller. If you have a four-year-old product, you have to know how much you're going to sell 4 years in advance. And if you're someone like Julian Van Winkle, who sells a 20-year-old product, you have to know 20 years in advance to know how much you're going to sell, make. So bourbon is very much in a high demand now, and supplies are very low. A lot of brands are getting discontinued now because they just don't have the whiskey to support them. Maker's Mark had that controversy about lowering their proof here because they were trying to make the whiskey they had go further because the demand is so great. Bourbon
is... Where's the demand coming from?
All over. United States, around the world. Bourbon is just selling in a phenomenal amount.
What age?
It's changing. When I first started doing this, when I was at United Distillers in the 90s, if I was doing a talk like this, about 80% of the crowd would be men of the age 45 to 70. And you look around here today, that's not the case. I have been very impressed in the last 4 or 5 years about the number of women that are becoming bourbon drinkers. I do a bourbon academy with Chris Morris out at Woodford Reserve every year, and it's been running. When we first started doing this, there may be one or two women in the class, and they were there because their husband or boyfriend dragged them along. For the last year, about 25% of the class has been women, and I would say probably 70% of them were there on their own without a boyfriend or a husband. It is definitely growing in popularity. I have been working with a young lady who's working at the University, New York University, in the food studies program. She is looking at the evolution of bourbon's image for her doctoral program. And she's writing her thesis on this, looking at bourbon over the years and see what type of image it had and how it's changed and such. And she teaches a class on spirits at New York University. And she says the women in the class are growing in number every year. And it's interesting because the women are very peeved, put it mildly, with the distilling industry at the way they're marketing to women. They don't want these flavored products that the distilling industry is saying, we're doing this because we're trying to get women involved, get them to like bourbon. To them, her idea for the perfect advertisement to women would be to have a woman walk into a bar with some guys sitting there drinking some foo-foo cocktail and walk up there and say, give me a shot of Wild Turkey Neat. And then when they, the bartender brings it over, and the guy looks over at it, she just kind of looks and says, yeah, what about it? That would sell more bourbon to women than anything that the distilleries are doing now. Because they're doing it not because it's advertised to women in particular. They're doing it because it has traditionally been a man's drink. And they're doing it because they say, yes, we have taste just as good as any man, and we can enjoy a product just as good as any man. There's a new group that's been out for about 4 years now called Bourbon Women. It has grown to about 500 members, with members in every state of the union now. Of course, it's primarily in Kentucky. And they have several programs every year. And a track, we had one at the Filson here back about 3 months ago, and well over 100 women showing up at the Filson to hear a talk on bourbon.
Did they bring their husbands and boyfriends?
A couple of them did.
Other questions? Anything you've been dying to ask about bourbon?
One quick question. Tennessee whiskeys or sour mash whiskeys?
Right.
Bourbon is a sour mash whiskey?
Mm-hmm.
What's the difference?
The big difference between Tennessee whiskey and bourbon whiskey is that charcoal mellowing process. Lynn Motlow from Jack Daniel's is a marketing genius. He got the distillery up and going in the 1940s. He applied for labels from the government, and they said, you can't call your product bourbon because of this charcoal mellowing process. You're changing the flavor between the still and the barrel, and you can't do that with bourbon. You can't call it bourbon. So he takes that letter of rejection and says, guess what? We're not a bourbon. The government says we're not a bourbon. We're a unique product. We're Tennessee whiskey. And that's where that comes from. He turns a negative into a positive. That mellowing process does change the whiskey between the still and the barrel. It really kind of jump starts the aging process. It also lowers the pH, or raises the pH, because it makes it more towards the base side instead of the acidic side, literally sweetening it up a little bit. And that's the Tennessee whiskey. Katie, do you have a question?
Yeah, you mentioned the growing popularity of bourbon around the country. There are now wineries in every single state of the union. Do you think that there are bourbon distilleries in every state?
It's getting close. There have been more distilling licenses issued in the last 10 years than the 100 years before. Craft distilling is taking off. There's craft distillers everywhere. Texas, Montana, California, Illinois, Michigan, New York, Wyoming. Steve Nally, who used to be the master distiller for Maker's Mark, is now working for a craft distiller in Wyoming, basically making a Maker's Mark-type product called Wyoming whiskey.
You're seeing more and more of the individual, private person,
right,
putting a still, a small still.
Right.
Which you can do legally.
You can do legally as long as you get the license. You know, unlike making wine or beer, there's not a certain amount of whiskey that you can make without a license. And that's for two main reasons. One is a safety issue. If you don't know what you're doing, you can kill yourself or someone else. And I'm not talking just about the danger of your still exploding. During Prohibition in particular, a lot of people were talking about getting the jack leg or the whiskey leg, and that was because these Prohibition illegal distilleries were not cutting the heads off. They were putting all the whiskey, all the alcohol spirits that they were making, and those first whiskeys off of a still and a pot still are wood alcohols and things that will make you go blind or kill you. And the other big reason is that the tax on whiskey is extremely high, and the government wants to make sure they collect every penny. If you go out and buy a $10 bottle of vodka, about $7.50 of that's taxes. So I always tell people, if you really are worried about the federal budget, go out and buy more bourbon, because the whiskey industry still pays a huge amount of taxes every year. You'll be putting Kentuckians back to work, and you'll have something good to show for it. Thank you all for having me.